So today we're in the park at Golden Gate. I'm with Lisa Licht.
Lisa Lichtinger.
We're just talking about the history of the being, the human being, the consciousness event, combined with the digital being in the 90s to create what's about to happen next. What's unique about this, as opposed to a pure tech world, is that it involves the evolution of, you know, human consciousness with other events, the cross-pollination of the technology of Silicon Valley with the consciousness of San Francisco, you know, and the cross-pollination of that began in the 67. I think it was a real renaissance kind of party there with Tim Leary and Richard Alpert and the Grateful Dead and wild Dionysian dancing on the park, face painting, people just totally enjoying themselves and relaxed and being very tribal.
I think just the transition of Dr. Richard Alpert into Ram Dass itself was one of the most natural examples of how someone can go straight from one dimension of reality and perspective into another, and not only that, a complete metamorphosis of their character and how you can, you know, rewire, reprogram, and neurologically make such a shift that even the message that you're actually bringing, like his full message started in one avenue, and he brought all of these people through this transitory period, and then many still were brought through his message all the way towards the end. So what he did basically was bring all these people through a historical time machine, you know, very quickly in his one life.
Wow. No, I hadn't thought of it that way. It's interesting.
That's just one way I like to look at it.
Yeah, and well, we're talking about media time machines now, so that would be an interesting journey to take someone through the Richard Alpert's transition.
Right.
From to Ram Dass, you know, there is some connection with the origins of Apple, and that you know Dan Kottke, and Dan's connection with, I think it was the same guru in India that Ram Dass was interested in, Neem Karoli Baba.
Yes.
And Dan and Steve Jobs were on the mission to get to the Neem Karoli Baba's. ashram. And unfortunately he died before they got there, but the good news is that that's where they got the lesson that the journey is the reward, I do believe, and that became one of the operating principles of Apple Computer,
right,
the largest corporation on the planet now, for a spiritual search in 1974.
But you see this message, you know, time and time and time again, and I think at least here in Silicon Valley and Bay Area, there's been more of an ability to embrace the fact that there's these conscious business models that are emerging. They're actually the attempts to infuse awareness and more of a mindful approach to building, you know, software and hardware. It's been interesting. It's been used for data analysis and performance optimization with like HR and the employees, you know, to get them more productive. But as that occurred, a really great result and benefit was that they not only became more productive for their role in work, you know, their specific work role, it improved their communication patterns with people. It improved their connection to nature. I mean, all of these, after there was like QA testing, you know, and there were different parameters that were measured. And this is just like a positive benefit. And then out of that, then we're beginning to see the quantified self forums, and consciousness hacking is growing and increasing. And
where does it all lead, you think?
And it all leads to at least people being more open-minded that mastery of the personal self is important.
The mastery of the personal self, which leads to some kind of new consciousness that...
having more personal integrity, and then you have more people that have more ambition and integrity and are able to identify in others the same mission and vision they have, and then you have these people come together, and then it creates a stronger conscious effort towards the what. I don't know what we're doing here, but towards, you know, so these people are moving together a little bit more unified. And then from 67 to now, you take all of the history, like in all of your, you know, future podcasts and everything in your media channel, you remember and you remind people all of that so they can take all of that with them, you know. It's like...
Keep integrated into their awareness.
Yeah.
You know, this whole process of unfoldment, it used to be that I was looking for the next clue, looking for clues. But now I feel very relaxed. I feel more, it's like, I'm just, instead of looking for clues, I'm following my cues.
You know,
it's like, you know, the universe is alive, so it's going to communicate with us and give us the right signals from moment to moment. And... Mm-hmm. Just have to tune into those, you know, and follow what goes. And because the universe loves us, it's got our best at its heart. It's not out there to kill us, you know. Like most people think, nature is something that's after us, or no, it's not. It's the opposite, you know. Summer Love came after that. Summer Love, which was about the books of love and the equation, high mind, the valley combined with the love to create like Apple, and now. It's a generation later, and then the next thing will be created. I think the corporations will pay for the parties, you know, the networking sessions, the events where people are brought together so magic can happen. I think that's how it's going to go. The corporate sponsors, and that's what this project needs, too. But in a way where it's integral. I mean, a lot of the 60s was anti-business, right? A lot of it, in order to get right with nature, you had to eschew the values of our culture to connect more directly, you know, and then there's an integration of that awareness with true abundance that redefines our understanding of money itself.
Right.
That is up now for evolution. We see Bitcoin coming in, we see cryptocurrencies, we're seeing other forms of money. There's several big plans by the multinationals even to topple the dollar and bring up Chinese money, for example. There's a lot of games around money. What's the best? Oh, what are the cues?
You know what would I think would be the best? Building a model where the human's vitality is their form of currency.
Well, kind of like the gross national happiness focus, more on,
could be,
you know, the state of mind, vitality,
could be.
A life energy,
could be. It could be one component, let's say, to the entire protocol. And to be able to infuse that with the manner in which we allocate and understand our transactions and interchanges and exchange in mass exchange. So right now there's frequency, data, pitch, decibel level, hertz coming from me. This is just science at the universe and at directed at you and this microphone, right?
Yeah.
So imagine if there was a frequency that people could literally tune into that had a certain kind of vibration, and if you tune into that frequency at a certain time, your human design, like, portfolio goes up.
Oh, you connect with the cloud.
or connect with the iCloud.
The ultimate eye.
Right. What you're saying is essential because, you know, you have this whole massive... So many people did so much work to raise awareness about awareness, period. And health. Health and...
Is it health, wealth, and
health,
wisdom? And
wealth and wisdom. And then you had, you know, this whole cycle coming back about the new enlightenment and then the Renaissance again. And then like a second Marxist wave. And then you had this whole spirituality kick that... It's all cyclical, you know, and it's happening daily.
Spiral, actually, I think of it.
Exactly, every few years, and then you had this whole light way showers and light workers, and then all this pull towards nature, and then we saw what happened with plant medicine suddenly in the West. You know, other places on the planet, you just grow up this way. I mean,
and then you start getting interested in things like longevity.
Yeah.
Because if you're going to be here for a while, you know, how can you be best,
exactly,
most healthy?
And how to justify, you know, the fact that you need to pay attention to your health now because supposedly insurance plans are going up. They're giving you more money because more years, and this is all happening now in all of the systems, right? Healthcare. And then it's really fascinating what you were saying, because then you take that and you talk about the financial markets, and then you have this consciousness movement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have these different systems coming into play that were kind of off the grid or kind of underground.
Yeah, different. They sort of developed in their own little eco niches, if you will.
Right.
Yeah.
When those become mainstream, then this is where we're at right now. I mean, we're in one of the most interesting times.
It is interesting because the concept of mainstream is shifting too.
Right.
Part of mainstream was defined by whether you watch CBS or NBC.
Right, or Fox.
Pravda.
Pravda.
Yeah, exactly. But now, everyone have a choice to be wherever they want.
Well,
right?
There is no mainstream. I mean, the tables of what is mainstream,
and
you can have access to anything.
I know, right? I mean... Okay. Yeah, so even mainstream, where it's all going isn't even mainstream anymore. I mean, it's going someplace else. It's going the ultimate individuality and probably the opposite, the ultimate connectedness, which would some would see as a form of fascism. But if I look at the human body, cells have to be somewhat fascistic to get all along. You know, probably the biological languages are probably very defined for very specific signals, means specific things to specific organisms. It's all, no, it's like, it's not abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And humanity is, we have abstraction. So it's another level of complexity to devise a collective consciousness for preserving that awareness and abstraction. The hardware's in place. Well, they all have the perfect bodies for the next level of evolution. And it's just a matter of the consciousness and it connecting with itself on a higher level. And I think that's what's happening. And the media can make it more fun and speed things up a little bit.
I think the media is one of the most interesting channels.
Yeah.
You were saying about the homeostasis of human beings. Longevity. I mean, we know that the thymus gland, for instance, once you turn 50, suddenly, like, you see your body starts to decline, and this is, you know, what happens.
Yeah, there's a whole cycle. I mean, it happens with every living organism.
Right. And now, you know, you have ketonic diets, I think what they're called, and you have people that are working on different T cells and things like that are actually changing the way that the thymus is functioning. So they're actually...
Thymus,
and they're actually already allowing regeneration of this. This is a very big deal, because this means that the whole human design can optimize for, you know, so many more years, and then the social impact that has on the world economy, I mean, the risks you take, everything just changes once we start to see that. You know, the body is much more capable of thought and brain and thoughts.
I mean, it's a fascinating time with this. I mean, it comes down to where do you want to put your attention to play with it, you know?
Exactly.
Where's your passion in this process, you know?
Exactly.
And that's one of my passions, and I keep on getting hit with it as a topic through different chapters in my life, and it's the idea of bioenergy, that there's some kind of energy that comes from the human body that indicates life force or the life energy. There are various scientists that have tried to define it. It's always been on the fringe of science. Wilhelm Reich with orgone energy, who I had a teacher in school who was a student of Reich's, and so I had a heavy dose of Reich in my life in college. Orgone accumulators, sighting psychics, you know, all kinds of interesting things in Montreal. I had a Carillion photography lab where I was studying energy.
What did you find, or what did it show you?
It was extremely crude. It showed that there's something to do with biology and interaction of biology with electricity. And that life force has something to do with electricity, but it's not exactly electricity. I guess it's electricity imbued within an intelligence of some sort, or an awareness. It's like maybe the liquid, somehow consciousness is connected to it as well.
Sounds like data streaming at light speed.
Maybe. Maybe, you know, it's like more than just light. It's data. Yeah, data. It's intelligence. It's
streaming. I mean, then that would connect to your media channel. Can you imagine?
That's a profound thought. It's good. Yeah, media, life energy, life force, electricity.
If we could all stream our own essence, let's say, our very core essence, such as in a financial exchange, right? Mm-hmm. What are we streaming there? Some kind of electricity is going on, some kind of data that we're taking that we use to exchange for goods and services and communication and interaction sometimes.
Yeah.
And if we were streaming our own channel, our own essence as a channel, I think that's what you were talking about before with how we would be showing our experiences, tapping into something.
Yeah, you've multiple points of view. Yeah. It would then show all how they're all so similar in many ways too, and it's like you can identify species differences at that point. I think it would start to free up consciousness to be anywhere, anytime, which it is already anyway. And perhaps there are faster metaphysical techniques of learning how to move your consciousness from body to body. They probably are. It's channeling, you know, is probably related to this. Chances are consciousness is probably a quantum phenomenon, so it's non-local anyway, and is able to do stuff like move around. We just haven't figured a lot of that out yet. Mm-hmm. But maybe there are cultures that have done, you know, and also travel through time as we understand it, through living minds. Their ancestors lived through us in more ways than we realize, for example. Mm-hmm. And understanding how that all works, and where it's not a mystery of life and death, it's more known. And, you know, on a level, nature is totally aware of life and death. I mean, look, millions of bodies are being born and dying every second, and it's happening pretty rarely. It's not new. You know, it's something that's well understood on some level of life that we have access to. So on that level,
it's a course.
Yeah, it's a course, or it's a way of playing with reality. You know, that we've created because it's probably the best thing to do, unless we come up with something better.
Like living healthier longer.
For example, yeah. Yeah.
And then some people think the better is making the longer forever.
Well, let's just say that maybe fewer reboots. You know, where you stay awake longer before you have to reboot. Start again.
That makes sense.
You know, where you can kind of continue where you left off if you have to.
What does it mean if you finally never reboot again? What does that mean?
Yeah, I guess that's the mystery. You're out of here. You're beyond zero and one.
Yeah.
Longevity is, the older I get, the more I'm into it. I'll tell you that. It definitely, that increases with time, especially as the body starts aging. It's a fascinating thing. John Ferber, I noticed you mentioned, he's an old friend.
Yeah.
He's definitely been collecting a lot of information.
We were just at Radfest in San Diego.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think he was there, or he had intended to be there.
Have you met him? Have you hung out with him at all?
I think once in passing.
Okay, so it's like ships passing in the night.
You're right. Correct.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely need to increase my knowledge in that arena too, so whatever you think would be useful for me there.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Terry Grossman, I had a really interesting conversation with him. He is out of Denver. He does a lot of research on cancer and how to live longer, essentially, and how to eliminate. Apparently, he has his studies and research proving that you can eliminate anything like this from your body. He's Ray Kurzweil's doctor.
Yeah.
This is all he wanted to talk about. And he was really focused on the diet and the thoughts that you have and the community that surrounds you.
Yeah.
And being extremely active and very simple things. That's what he talked about.
They're finding, even with drug addiction, that if you have a good social life, that's more interesting than drugs. At least, you know, the narcotics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. To be able to associate certain social interactions with an excitatory response actually increases the serotonin and dopamine, and then
it's
a drug you can get.
Yeah.
And then if you know you have those friends, that you're not even around them, but you feel like this butterflies, and you're just like, and when you're around them, you just laugh and laugh and laugh.
Yeah.
This is equivalent to burning the same calories as being at the gym. It's equivalent to being high.
There is a new social paradigm here unfolding. Wow.
But to get people to be able to replicate this communication pattern time and time again under the stresses that the world imposes on us, that is the difficult situation.
You got to create the context for play, basically, for that to make it fun, make it interesting.
Or the events and parties
where
people are being stimulated, such as the ones that you're going to meet about today.
Oh, yeah, there are spother. There's a whole, it's fascinating when you think of it as a nervous system. Within every social network, there is like the networker or person that knows people in other social communities that are connected to them and link the people between them, and there's a natural flow to it. And then there's another layer where there's like what I call meta networkers, where they know a bunch of networkers. I'm thinking it'd be good to throw a party where you can just invite the meta networkers to meet each other.
Super nodes.
Super nodes.
Or human producers.
Yeah. And then introduce them to some people that they had no clue existed. That would be really interesting.
I agree completely.
So VR social spaces is what I'm really interested in, the tech side, where I can actually have people meet each other in a simulated experience that's as real as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the key, and as you know, to good social communications is feel that you can have eye contact, like you're looking at someone, they're looking at you.
Hi.
You can wave to them.
Hello. No, Mama, that's not great. We just started our new community.
There it is.
Our new recruit.
Yeah. If he comes in for it, you know.
Entrepreneur in residence.
Yeah, you never know who's going to come talk to you, right?
Yeah, who knows what message he has.
Yeah,
I think it's fantastic. The ability to use augmented or virtual mixed reality tools to insert or inject empathy into others. This is what they're trying to force it, but it's not something that becomes forced if you're, as you said, looking through this perspective or being shown through another lens, essentially, that it's so intimate through virtual reality because there's so many more dimensions. The extension of 3D is much more visually stimulating.
I think so. I think it'd be really interesting to play with 3D to see where it really works well and where it interferes with the quality of the connection. I want people to feel comfortable when they're in it and to be themselves, because I think that's where, not that we can't have some actors to have some fun with it, but that might be good to start things off for people who are first experiencing it.
Right.
Did I ever tell you that my early, no, I guess I haven't. Did you know Henry Dakin? Have you ever heard of Henry Dakin?
I don't believe so.
Okay, well, this was an interesting chapter. He was a scientist whose family ran a toy company here, called the Dakin Toy Company.
Okay.
It became one of the most successful toy companies that made plush teddy bears.
Mm-hmm.
And they did very well. And then there was a very tragic accident where all of Henry's family were killed in a car accident. And he was left with the reins of the corporation. And he's a nuclear physicist, you know, he was in the lab, you know, UC Berkeley and Livermore and stuff like that. And suddenly he had millions of dollars of this company.
Mm-hmm.
And naturally he spent it not on things that normal millionaires would spend money on. But he was interested in like telepathy and things like that. And he actually created a telepathy lab here in San Francisco.
Okay.
Then expanded it to other ESP things. They brought Uri Geller in, worked with Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff, who were connected with SRI, and they were studying psychics like Ingil Swann, and to see whether or not they could demonstrate telepathy or demonstrate psychokinesis and things they were interested in, or a psychokinetic phenomenon. And Henry was involved behind a lot of that. So remote viewing, was very big. It's good you know about this stuff. That's
cool. There's still a group actually that meets that started with Ingo Swann.
Really? Wow.
And I've met with them a few times out in Pleasanton or Pleasantville.
Just down the East Bay?
Yes.
Wow.
And they've told me these stories.
Oh, fantastic. Well, they're probably part of that network,
I believe so.
That connects in with the scientists at Esalen, the Esalen scientists in And Russell Targ was hanging out with Nick Herbert, who's one of the quantum physicists from that group.
Right, Nick.
Nick, you know Nick?
I think we spoke once.
Oh, you spoke, yeah. Yeah, you have to come to one of our parties.
Certainly. Yeah, I look forward to that.
Good.
So very interesting. Bringing back to the RadFest, another conversation I had with Jose Cordero.
Yes.
Who's really big into singularity and lifeboat and helping entrepreneurs in Latin American countries, in the U.S. as well, and I think some other places, Asia and in Europe. He's very set on the fact that the way that we're developing our human design and in how it's being coupled, essentially, with all the tech that we're using. He's talking about it as a revolution where telepathy is not something that is that far off. It's something that's going to be necessary for all of us to use as everything becomes more accelerated and amplified. So he's talking about the importance of us being able to communicate and connect honestly, compassionately, transparently.
Yeah. Emotional literacy.
With integrity, I mean, fluid intelligence, openness. And
I think it's Marshall Rosenberg.
Yes. And that essentially, this is going to help because
all these words,
you can't progress if we're going to be working so quickly or just operating so quickly that the words will become less and the rest will just be understood, you know, commonplace understanding of many concepts.
Otherwise it would have been much slower in the past. I already noticed that at the difference between official UN people, for example, and NGOs.
Okay.
Have you ever been to a UN conference?
Mm-hmm.
You know, where there's
several. Yes.
Like I was at the women's rights one in Beijing, and and also one in Austria about human rights. The interesting thing is that the things seem to move at a glacial speed in the UN in terms of motions and passes and that sort of thing, and all the real juice, all the real connections and the people-to-people sharings that I saw, where there was a real empathy and compassion and love, was hanging with the NGOs, you know, from around the world.
Interesting.
That's where you saw a real energetic exchange.
Mm-hmm.
The UN people, by comparison, at least from my outside point of view, was that they were like robots. You know, passing pieces of paper and signing it, and not to do this and only to do that. And they have all these rules, you know? And there are people that have to navigate those waters. And maybe that's fun, but it was much slower. But unfortunately, the NGOs don't have any power. So even though they have better connectivity and more compassion for each other as people, there was a lot of intention going on at the time in the 90s when I was there. It's the Serbia-Croatia was at war. And that was a very, very big topic.
I've heard this. I've heard this before. This commentary about the UN.
Yeah.
And I think it's because there's a lot of other alternative forces in control there within the UN that doesn't allow such a...
I'm sure it's rife with back channels too, I'm sure.
Sure.
In that world.
Yes.
But there could be another layer. Now, we first thought about this in virtual reality. Whether or not we could start a virtual country. Right?
I know quite a few people
passports and everything
that are using VR to test that out.
Yes, yeah.
It happened in Second Life, right?
I don't know. Did they test out there? They tried to issue Second Life passports, driver's licenses?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And then BitNation is trying to do this, not in VR, but in real reality.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You mentioned this VR, and my friend Barry at Hausman and his co-founder Mario.
Yeah.
I forget his last name. They're out of Oakland, and they have Variable Labs. Actually, they're going to be demoing and presenting at my VR data science meetup next month. They filmed in VR in some developing countries, and they were one of the first to show, backed by the UN, to show the impact of seeing, you know, these sites through VR and how it can foster empathy.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I think
this is what they were doing initially.
Yeah. The 4K 360 video stuff, I think, would can convey empathy the most from the formats I've seen so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think for empathy to work in communications, it's especially audio, where you have the undertones, you have more of an FM quality sound rather than a normal telephone, which cuts off a lot of that, that the empathic levels of communication that occur. So you need good quality audio. I think the video doesn't have to be perfect, but the audio has to be perfect for good communication. And then eye-wise, I think it could be low res, a little bit for the face, but eye contact would be preferable. You know, or avoidance of eye, because people like to avoid contact too. It's a big game, right? So it really is a big part of human communications to play with the eyes. So I think play with the eyes would be the next thing. Now, Brett's been involved with a company that is directly working with eye contact. He knows as a director how important that is for telling stories here. And he's seeing that the new mythos that he wants to tell from a cinematic point of view is the emergence of the global human, right? And what it means to be a global human, instead of defining the mythology around a cast of characters that are all global humans. Who are these people and what do they think about?
So beings without borders, perhaps.
Different borders, right? I mean, we're still human.
Without the borders we're familiar with.
Yeah, think of yourself as one, you know, as somebody that connects with people on a global scale. It doesn't matter what country they're from. You have the connection on a psychic, emotional level. Then that's what you're here to do. And you recognize it when you see it.
That would make a fascinating film education piece.
Yeah. Oh, you can bring cameras into virtual space and shoot movies, you know, from a traditional 2D point of view,
right,
just like you can in reality.
Right.
So.
Very, like a recursive.
Yes.
Filming a film
or a subset.
Yeah.
Or, you know, well, look, you know, if we put on a party in virtual space and all these great conversations are going on, you're not going to be able to be at all of them when you're there, and you probably would like to visit a few of them later. I've certainly been there once through a party called the Crystal Ball, and I was combining the cultural creatives of the Bay Area with Silicon Valley movers and shakers at a club in the Valley.
I would have loved to have been there.
It was, you had to come in costume, too.
I would have dressed like myself.
Are you? Okay, well, our rules were you had to come as your hero or heroine.
Oh, then She-Ra, perhaps.
She-Ra, all right. All right.
Yeah. With my crystal sword.
Perfect. Superpowers are in.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Being, that's
yeah.
That's the new super being.
Absolutely.
That you're talking about, right?
Yeah. Why not? I mean, that you come as your hero. I there's a great concept. It should be repeated in virtual space, I think.
I agree.
Especially since we can play with bodies so easily in virtual space. Right. Why not have some superhero?
Different avatars.
Which would be the new mythologies? They would be the ones that you resonate with, that you connect with. Yeah.
Character.
Yeah, I think the Greeks and the Romans did a great job. Some of the mythos, so could certainly borrow from that. But I think that the comic books are great inspiration for other generations, so graphic novels. And I guess the ultimate is create your own superhero. You know, you borrow a little bit from all the others and build your own superhero, which is basically what we're doing anyway.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah. So VR social spaces, I think I'd like to see that as one of the things to bring across for the virtual being. Because the tie-in is that in the 90s, there was a wave of the first technology, interactive technology, that hit the Bay Area, and the cultural creative community really embraced that. The first microcomputers that could do video, that could do gesture language. They started to be able to play virtual instruments, to talk to people over a distance, and that's evolved into Skype and now Zoom. And getting the companies to set up a VR social experience, both an Oculus Rift and Valve. I think those are the two initial ones.
And, one thing that you made me think, you were mentioning blockchain and Bitcoin and then Skype, and I just made a connection, you know. His name is Gian Tallin, I believe. He was involved with Skype, and now he's really, really almost obsessed with anything having to do with singularity and fintech. If you think about it, initially in the beginning, people were looking at Skype and saying, well, that's great, but we have telephones and we can do video conferencing with telephones, and then Skype basically took over, right?
Yeah, I used video telephones a lot, so I saw that change. Yeah.
Right, you there and you were
yeah, that was
it.
My thing for a while.
Right, so yeah. For various reasons, yeah. Right? It was quicker, faster, cheaper, it was free, I think it's still free at some point, Skype.
You know, our first connections with that stuff was a single picture that took 10 seconds to transmit over a phone line. It was like a video fax. And our first ones were to parties in Russia, actually. And it made a big deal. It was very powerful, and ultimately it was subversive.
Right.
Because we saw Russian people, they were people. Americans, all the programming, we thought they were like Klingons. And they were just people like us.
Right.
And that was very subversive to be aware of that, because then there's nothing to worry about.
Yes. You have all of these people that are able to give their resources, let's say just some cash or money or something, cyber money, and the value of the human being is changing by their ability, not and also, of course, by how much wealth is backing them, but not only that, the manner in which they're able to exchange the wealth that they have. This is one thing that...
PayPal.
Right, right.
You know, it's interesting because you can exchange faster and faster.
Exactly.
Apple Pay, they had Trader Joe's, and, you know, it's all going very quickly, machine to machine. The next level, I think, is where the...
We have Ring wallets being made right now. Yeah, one of our projects.
Well, here's the thing. The thing is that we are carrying these supercomputers in our pockets, and they've gotten very good at extracting money from us. But they're supercomputers. They should be part of projects where they make money for us. Right? They should generate abundance.
And
I think that is a new type of app that's focused on abundance creation.
There's some marketplaces.
Yeah.
There's some marketplaces run by cryptocurrency and bitcoins and altcoins that are actually doing this and bringing back the funds to the content creators.
Ah.
This is one way that this is happening.
Right.
Like bazaars on different networks and things like that, where, so see, it's not only the wealth, because you can create the wealth out of nothing, out of creating data, out of creating content. You're like literally there, using whatever tools you have, creating software, and so this is being like unleashed
already
onto the planet.
Yeah, see, that will shift things. If a huge abundance paradigm or way of making money or a way of replacing making money hits, like through these phones, that's the underpinning of the existing paradigm. You know, if the money system unravels or something else better comes along, actually is what we're talking about, not unraveling it, but making something way better, then the whole thing would be abandoned for the better. And that's how nature works, right? It would just... and something, if it was really radical, something like that would happen.
Yeah, it looks like there'll be much more of a radical shift with these technologies that are emerging.
Wow, that's exciting. That's truly disruptive.
Yeah, economic space endeavors and all of these fascinating things.
Amazing times.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
Stay tuned here. We're going to change to the next chapter here. Thanks, Lisa, for your presence.
Yeah, of course.
Appreciate it.
It's
we
a
shall
pleasure.
Continue shortly.
Okay.